So your latest album is music of Johannes Brahms, and you've got the two cello sonatas on here as well as these two songs. Let's talk a little bit about the sonatas, and, and certainly, Jeannie, you know, chime in, because the piano plays more or less an equal part with the cello in these two sonatas.
Or I think it's an unequal part. I have about four times more notes than Norman does at all times, in so, every bar.
Sonata for piano with cello accompaniment.
Exactly. Then. Well, no, I mean, I think it's integrated, but nonetheless, the pianist always has more notes. And it's a total collaboration in every respect, and Brahms really does that up in a very meaningful way.
Yeah. Well, Brahms was a pianist, so
right.
I imagine a lot of that went into it as well.
He also
exactly.
played cello and French horn.
Did he really?
Yeah. In his earlier days, his dad was a horn player, and so he actually played along with his dad a bit, and he studied the cello a bit, although he never took that out in public.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start with the sonata number one. These two sonatas are separated by a couple of decades, so it's interesting to hear them back to back.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us a little background on that first sonata?
The first sonata is actually the first one that Brahms agreed to be published. It's interesting to note, and he did this also with some of his other chamber music, that he would write any number of pieces, and then instead of tucking them into a drawer, he threw them into the fire to make sure that nobody would find them. But in this first sonata, he really felt that he found something that was just right, and he was very proud of it. He did the first two movements, and then a third movement, a slow movement, which he eventually discarded but used later in the F major sonata, and waited a few years before he actually wrote the last movement, which is much more virtuosic than the previous two movements.
Hmm.
One of the things I find interesting about this, just from a historical perspective as an American, the range of dates in which this happens, in which he was writing this first sonata, happens just with our American Civil War. It kind of puts things in a very unusual perspective, thinking about what was going on in the United States at the same time as Brahms writing this cello sonata.
Yeah.
He had an idea about writing as an homage to Bach, and you see certain kinds of Baroque counterpoint. A second movement instead of a slow movement is a minuet, so a Baroque dance. And the last movement actually is inspired by several contrapunti from Bach's Art of the Fugue. And he puts the cello and piano in dynamic counterpoint, one against the other, but not just in normal Baroque fashion, but also in very new juxtaposition of metric transformations. It's very exciting and sometimes very unsettling what he does with it.
Yeah.
But it's a compositional tour de force. And just, I would say, from the standpoint of the cello repertoire, that there are a few pieces that we can say as cellists that really capture our persona as cellists. This first sonata of Brahms is one, the Beethoven A major cello sonata, and of course, the Dvorak concerto.
Yeah. A couple of things that you said really caught my attention. Number one, putting it in context with American history and the Civil War, that never occurred to me before, and I imagine a lot of listeners don't think of it necessarily in those terms.
Yeah. The dates are striking, 1862 to about 1865.
Yeah, that's a kind of mind-blowing, actually, to think of it that way. But also this idea that Brahms was such a student of musical history and that he researched, you know, the music of Johann Sebastian Bach and incorporated a lot of that into his work. I know that listeners don't necessarily even think of it that way, that he was in some ways, you know, a musical historian.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And also a collector of musical manuscripts.
Yeah.
At one time, he owned, I can't remember the exact number of items in his library, but he owned Mozart's autograph to one of the symphonies. He actually owned one act of Tannhäuser, and when Wagner heard about this, that he'd gotten that, he was outraged and demanded to get it back. But Brahms had a whole network of collectors that he could get songs and other kinds of things from Schubert and these things. So he had all these manuscripts in his own possession.
So interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the second sonata, because these are, again, separated by a number of years. I'm not sure what was going on in American history in 1886, but I'm sure something was going on.
Exactly.
But certainly in the case of Brahms, this second sonata, can you tell us a little bit about that? And then, you know, maybe compare it a little bit to the first sonata, because if we listen to them back to back, there are some similarities and some differences. I'm almost struck more by the similarities than I am by the differences.
That's interesting. I mean, Norman just talked about the first sonata's last movement, which is virtuosic and rhythmically extremely complex. The second sonata really capitulates on that idea where the rhythm is incredibly complex all the time. And for the pianist, it is really much more complex in terms of the geography of getting around the piano. It is really a huge orchestration, which is extremely common with Brahms, specifically at that particular time, Opus 99. And so for the pianist, there is no question that it is immensely more complex than the first sonata, where one could almost imagine that one is more an accompanist than a complete collaborator, as we were just speaking about before. So the second sonata is tremendously problematic for the piano. You're really working the entire instrument of that particular period. He's thinking huge orchestrational issues, brass and winds and strings at all times. Lots of the opening, for instance, of the first movement of the F major is a tremolo concept with the cello bursting out of this tremendous amount of rhythmic energy. And so it is just a much more complex piece to play as a collaborative pianist, and I think as a cellist also.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would say that, first of all, we think about the range that Brahms is using in the cello writing of the first sonata, which is in the low to mid register. He throws that out completely in the Opus 99, the F major sonata. He has the cello playing at the very top of the instrument, all over with bow strokes that are wildly virtuosic and tremendous new ideas about rhythm. You know, Schoenberg talked about this F major sonata because Schoenberg was a cellist. And he said when that sonata came out, all the cellists were scratching their head and couldn't figure it out. And they just said, I think Brahms was out of his mind. And nobody played the piece for many, many years until a few just tackled it and started figuring it out.
Yeah.
But it's hard for us to appreciate the almost radical ideas that Brahms was bringing out in this sonata.
Yeah, that's wonderful to think about before we actually listen to it as listeners. How long have you been playing these sonatas together? I imagine your history goes back a ways.
That's a very good question. I'm wondering now myself. Probably. Actually, I think that I played the F major sonata, some of it, when I was an undergraduate at Oberlin, but with another cellist, by the way. I think I tackled the scherzo movement. I have a very vivid memory of playing it with I can't remember whom, and thinking this is pretty complicated stuff. The scherzo of the F major with double thirds and double sixths and really complex physical issues at the piano. I loved the energy of it, but I'm sure that it was not a very good performance. So, I mean, in those days, one took one movement at a time. And so I'm trying to remember at what stage we began that piece, but I'm guessing we have been playing those pieces for 30 years.
Yeah.
I'd say I think I played the E minor in 1966.
And I was 3 years old at the time.
That's something like
the
that.
The F major a few years late, probably 1969. Yeah.
Well, the way you talk about it and having listened to it, it seems like the kind of music that you have to live with for decades, really, to get to the heart of the matter, as it were.
Well, the joy of our lives together, and both as active performers and as teachers, is that we're activating our curiosity about the materials on a perpetual basis.
Yeah.
And so new kinds of insights and ways of seeing the music and hearing its possibilities with character construction just gets ever more vivid as the perceptions of detail go deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
I have to share a story. Just a few weeks ago, a student of mine heard the slow movement by a fellow student and one of our staff pianists of the F major, and he was so overcome, literally with tears, that he had to leave. He was completely amazed. He'd never heard it before, and he came to me the next week with his lesson and said, "I have a colleague who's just asked me to play the F major Brahms. Can I do it? Please?" He said, "The question is, can I make it through the slow movement?" I said, "Well, I have the same problem every time I play it. Yeah. I just have to distance myself because it is so devastatingly beautiful and mournful and joyful at the same time. And I have trouble making it through every time I play it."
Wow. Yeah, that's so wonderful.
It is amazing.
Norman, I have to say, you have a remarkable speaking voice.
Oh, thanks, Brad, as do you. Well,
but your daughter is also on here, and yeah, she has a wonderful singing voice, as we know, Abigail Fisher. And I'm used to hearing her sing contemporary music.
Right.
It's wonderful to hear her dig into these beautiful Brahms songs.
Yeah.
You want to talk about those a little bit for us?
Oh, well, you know, sure. It's, as you mentioned, the songs are also separated by a period of about 20 years and had a different mandate, essentially, by them. Brahms wrote these pieces for his dear friend Joachim and his wife, who was this wonderful contralto, Emilie Schneeweis, and their first child they named Johannes. And so the Geistliches Wiegenlied, which is the second of the songs, was written in honor of their baby, Johannes. And it is taken from this Christmas carol, "Joseph Dearest, Joseph Mine," and incorporates that into the song. At the same time, there's a lot of turbulence with the Christ child, what's going to happen with Herod and the flight to Egypt, and all this sort of stuff is going on. And Mary is saying, "Be still, be calm. Let the winds die down so that my baby can go to sleep."
Yeah.
In the first song, the Gestillte Sehnsucht, had a different mandate. At this point, Joseph Joachim and Emilie Schneeweis were having problems with their marriage, and they were both very close friends with Brahms, and he decided that he would write a song from the Rückert that dealt with a lot of aspects of troubled relationships and turbulence. Mm. And in each case, this had a solo viola, which, of course, Joachim not only played violin, but viola, and Schneeweis would be singing and Brahms would be playing at the piano. So it's unusual to have an obbligato with this.
Yeah.
At the time that it was published, Brahms also made a cello version of this. So it is the same, basically, as the viola, but sometimes different octaves. And, of course, the cellists think that it's much better than the viola version, of course.
It's different. I mean, I had played for many, many years those wonderful songs with violists, and they would probably be horrified to hear that there's now a recording with with cello, because they have so much. They're stealing from other instruments all the time.
Yeah.
But for a cellist to steal their repertoire, I think they'll be upset. But it's okay, because it's so beautiful with the cello.
It adds a depth that is a little different, because it puts it down into that baritone register that creates a different identity versus the voice than putting the voice and the instrument in similar register.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening to it, it felt more like a bit of a duet with two different voices.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Somebody kind of shadowing, you know, the voice. So lovely compliment to the sonatas, these two songs. I feel like after this conversation, I'm completely equipped to go back and listen again now.
Oh, good.
So
that's wonderful.
Well, the album is Music of Johannes Brahms. That's from the Centaur record label. Cellist Norman Fisher and pianist Jeannie Kierman, also Abigail Fisher, singing those songs. The Fisher Duo, thank you so much for joining us here on FM 91.
Thank you,
thank
Brad.
You
it's
so
been
much
wonderful
for having
talking
us.
To you.